Hello and welcome to the ERP Organizational Change Journal podcast, brought to you by Nessel & Associates. Nessel & Associates is an ERP organizational change management firm serving the private equity industry. Hello, my name is Jonathan Donald, the founder of Invert Ventures, a change strategy firm. I'm here with my co-host, friend, and colleague, Dr. Jack Nessel, the founder of Nessel & Associates. The ERP Organizational Change Journal podcast seeks to share expertise, insight, and create effective conversation to help guide ERP and organizational change to real, measurable, and verified success, expanding what we can see so we can act in a more effective way. We seek to promote, connect, and foster relationships in the ERP and organizational change community. The primary purpose of our podcast is to discuss, share, and reflect upon effective and efficient ways in which to realize ERP organizational change success. We will discuss the people, process, and technological components of ERP organizational change. Our podcast is intended as a forum to study, share, and discuss ERP and organizational change, and it's our sincere hope that our podcast is a collaborative tool and resource to impart useful wisdom and discuss lessons learned, best practices, and the human elements of ERP and organizational change. Our podcast draws on knowledge from extensive research, collaborative learning, practitioner experience, and that experiences of both project successes and project failures. A review of the general themes of ERP and organizational change practice, literature, and research suggests that understanding and critically having an awareness of tactical approaches founded in principle is fundamental to ERP and organizational change success. Our podcast will discuss these tactics, review these approaches, and discover the principles that they're founded upon so that they may prove to be useful to you in addressing your ERP and organizational change challenges and risks to ensure that we learn how to transform organizations for the better. Jack?
Thank you, Jonathan. I'm really looking forward to interviewing our next guest, as we are a podcast that desires to engage in valuable insight into the world of ERP organizational change success with interviews and roundtable talk. Our guests include experts and pioneers in the field, organizational stakeholders, practitioners, and researchers. We're a discussion on any and all things ERP and organizational change, and our podcast is a platform for those seeking to share, learn, and reflect on ERP organizational change success.
I'm super excited for this conversation, and the title of this episode is The Role of Business Intelligence in Supporting Supply Chain Management, in which we'll discuss decision support models, data mining, information system, project management, risk management, and generally data analytics with Dr. David Olson. Dr. David Olson is the James H.K. Stewart Professor, Chancellor's Distinguished Chair, and a professor of supply chain management analytics at the University of Nebraska. His areas of expertise include decision-making, simulations, quantitative analysis, data mining, supply chain, and the management of general information systems. Some of his recognitions and awards include the Best Enterprise Information System Educator, the FIFIPT C8 International Conference on Research and Practical Issues of Enterprise Information Systems in 2006, and the Risk Management Paper of the Year in 2010. We are really excited to have Dr. Olson with us today.
Thanks again, Jonathan. Often in the context of ERP system discussions, as well as discussions around ERP organizational change, one often hears words such as decision support models, data mining, information systems project management, and of course, risk management. Today, we are fortunate to be able to discuss these important topics with an expert in these specific areas. In this episode, we will discuss each of these areas, and we will discuss how do we define each of these areas, what are their value, and what's the latest in terms of research and application in these areas. We're going to ask the question, where are each of these fields of study heading, and what does it mean to your business? So without further ado, we'll ask our guest, Dr. Olson is a longtime friend, mentor, and colleague. His enthusiasm and passion about sharing his work and advancing the field of information systems management is contagious and exciting. Dr. Olson, thank you so much for being on our show today.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure working with you in the past, and I look forward to this podcast.
Thank you. Well, all right, let's dive in. So, Dr. Olson, no doubt ERP is about improved business intelligence. And in terms of ERP and ERP organizational change, business analytics, decision support models, data mining, and information systems project management, and of course, as mentioned previously, enterprise and risk management are key notions in providing, as well as ensuring, business intelligence. In one or two sentences, how would you define each of these for our listeners?
The first one you have is decision support models. Decision support systems have been around for about 30 years, and they originally were defined as the use of computers to access data and apply models to specific decisions. Actually, it's kind of interesting to me in different fields, fields to have different definitions. MIS, or Management Information Systems, people tend to focus on computer systems. Operations research is the area that I'm mostly in, and that's mostly math modeling, like optimization. In the ERP domain, these models have been applied in things like forecasting from the onset, as well as accounting kinds of exercises. And then, maybe 20 years ago, customer relationship management became a big item. It started off as an add-on from Siebel, and then, of course, the ERP companies swallowed that up and made it a component of their systems internally.
Yep.
And it's kind of an ever-evolving road of progress as vendors find new and useful applications to add to ERP and related kinds of systems, usually related to repetitive kinds of things like forecasting.
Sure. So what about data mining?
And data mining is, I view it as statistical analysis. I find it interesting in that statisticians viewed it originally as a pejorative term for poor statistical practice of throwing in the kitchen sink. But as it became useful, I remember I had a department head that was a very well-known statistician. When companies started to pay him money to give them advice on data mining, suddenly he became a data mining proponent. Essentially, it's digging through the data to find interesting and actionable knowledge, and I think the component that makes it different than traditional statistics is the large scale of data that's out there, like big data, and the real-time access that's possible, and that can be encoded in ERP systems, potentially, like customer relationship management.
Sure. So how would you define then the third item, business analytics?
That's a high level term that includes mathematical modeling applied to business. I think that like the Institute for Operations Research and Management Science is something I belong to about 50 years now. They have kind of made that buzzword their focus in the last 20 years. And essentially, it means applying quantitative analysis to business decisions. It includes the models I talked about before of optimization, like mathematical programming, as well as statistical analysis or probabilistic modeling to include things like simulation.
Okay. So how would you, for our listeners, how would you define information systems project management?
Well, project management is a separate but related idea to the business analytics that I've talked about. In operations management, they've always been interested in project management as a specific field, like things like critical path modeling. But in the operations field, I started work in construction, but the projects there I think are quite a bit different than the ones in information systems. They both involve repetitive activities where you can learn from your past experiences, but in information systems, there's so much variance in, you know, how long does it take to make a program work? It's impossible to guess. And so there's a higher level of risk in information systems project management. But it is a very important field in information systems. things like systems analysis and design started off to include business process reengineering, and then coding and testing and installation. And so those kind of repetitive activities show up over and over. And things like Carnegie Mellon's CMMI procedure try to make that a formal process and get level 5 certification and whatnot. In the ERP domain in the 90s, it was a major challenge to successfully implement ERP systems.
Yeah.
It used to take years, and there was a high level of failure. And in the 2000s, these initial systems often needed upgrading, and that created a different kind of project that we'll talk about in a little bit. But they gained a lot of experience and understanding. But still, the first time you implemented the ERP system, vendors have become more mature and able to remove much of the variance and uncertainty, but there's still a lot of organizational impact that you probably are very interested in, organizational change.
Yeah, absolutely. So when you talk about the challenges and the risk of ERP organizational change, that's pretty inherent in especially large-scale ERP organizational change, that is risk and challenges. So along with that, there's this idea or this field or this notion that you're an expert in, and that's enterprise and risk management. How would you describe that? What does that mean?
Okay, risk management is a broad term that started off in finance and accounting, really, things like value at risk for financial people, but it certainly is present in the ERP domain. They have a lot of characteristic risks like that are common to information systems projects where you have critical success factors that you often find important, like top management support and user involvement and using sound processes. The general idea of risk management is to identify what can go wrong and threaten your organization should they go wrong. And managing them involves anticipating risks and developing contingency plans and monitoring progress and having alternatives available. Right now in the supply chain domain, COVID-19 creates a lot of new challenges, and organizations that have had alternative sources in place, I think, did better than ones that were unable to cope with it. And supply chains are still going through that process. In the ERP domain, you have this risk that's diminishing with time as, you know, decades of experience build up. I think in general, risk management's accomplished by building up some slack. And that conflicts directly with the idea of profit maximization that supply chains try to get with lean systems. Balancing that is a real managerial challenge.
Sure.
You can't say don't be lean, but the leaner you are, the more risk you take on.
Right. Yeah, interesting. Well said.
Dr. Olson, thank you, first of all, for setting such a firm context for our listeners. A lot of these terms have become buzzwords in my experience, and so that definition really gives us an opportunity to dig deeper. Also, what a fantastic point about the leanness of operations also being a risk, that optimization means potentially you're less robust.
Absolutely.
Just fantastic. I want to take an opportunity to dive a little deeper into business analytics. Over the last 5 years, visual analytics, whether it's Microsoft's Power BI or Tableau, which is now a part of SAP, have basically become ubiquitous across large-scale organizations. And they're growing at almost every level. What has happened to business analytics that's really made it so expansive? In other words, what advancement in this field is really unlocking its usability and its value for organizations?
I think the technology that makes big data available is probably the primary difference. Now there's this massive amounts of data in real time that computer systems are able to cope with. You mentioned SAP picking up Tableau. That's an excellent example of what I was thinking about earlier, about the evolution of things.
Yeah.
And ERP systems are building in new tools like that on a constant basis. Data mining, to me, like I said before, is statistically based. There are some artificial intelligence tools like neural networks and decision trees, but basically it's statistics applied on a large scale that can be applied to this big data as it comes online.
Sure.
When you say big data for our listeners, right, there's a tendency, at least on the business side, to see big data as solely external, whether it's mined from social media.
Oh, no, I would say ERP is a big source of big data.
Okay.
You know, the cash register data that Walmart mines, I think would be a major source of big data.
So this is really important. When we're defining big data here, we're also talking and specifically talking about internal sources of big data. So what's the definition
of big data? As well as external. I think the main thing is scale and time, you know. In millions of observations as opposed to the 30 or 40 or 300 that you could handle with pen and paper?
Sure. So scale and time?
Yeah.
Time is in real time?
Yeah, well, it's real time. I mean, especially with internal data, your cash register data comes in over the line in real time.
So what's fantastic about this is that you're giving us and our listeners a totally different definition. One that I think is actually much more usable for big data. So it's really, if I understand you correctly, regardless of the source, it's about the scale of data, millions of observations over time. And that data is being manipulated and understood in real time rather than post to make forecasts.
And I admit that that's probably an ideal definition. You know, there's a few problems in coping with that, you know. It creates opportunities for mistakes, but I think companies are accessing their cash register data in real time and making decisions based upon that. It enables them to make pricing decisions in real time. I mean, it's kind of like financial trading. That's another example of big data. You got all this stock trading data that's Bloomberg terminals are there to mine. That's a different domain, but companies do the same things with their inventories and their stocks.
Right. And so what has that unleashed in organizations from your experience and perspective?
I think it's made companies like Walmart successful and enabled them to gain a tremendous competitive advantage when they specifically have invested heavily in computer systems, to include ERP. They have taken advantage of that and been able to overwhelm what used to be five and dime stores before you were born.
Probably.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was a different world. And it provides a great deal of value to the economy and to all of us, although it also is very disruptive. A lot of cities make a lot of trouble for Walmart trying to move in, because it does disrupt the traditional economy of places.
So, Dr. Olson, I want to just dive into the data mining conversation a little bit more. There's two important ideas that you recently wrote about in a couple of articles. I believe they were both in 2019 with your colleagues. I believe it's Lauhoff and Wu. And it's the idea of two different data mining models, descriptive and predictive. Can you explain
Could expand that to four. These were books, actually, that I've used in class. I am using in class. Right now I'm teaching a descriptive data mining class, and that relates to visualization of what's happened mostly. And so you have tools like cluster analysis and basic statistics, and a lot of visualization is really helpful to see what's going on or what has happened. The algorithms there are much weaker. They're things like association rules, which are a good example of big data because they're very simple kinds of things, but they're trying to identify if somebody bought, say, one kind of book, what are the odds that they'll buy another? What's the best thing to cross-sell?
Sure.
And that's in real time, and that's what Amazon does very well. And so predictive data mining is a step up from that. It's trying to forecast or predict, and there are a lot of powerful tools to come up with with decision trees of if these variables have these values, then you can expect this result kind of an output. And logistic regression is another tool, and as well as neural networks and support vector machines to classify things. And that's very useful in things like fraud detection in insurance companies, or bank loan analysis, or many other applications where you're trying to say, what can you expect? And profiling things for customer relationship management. You know, what kinds of things will that type of profile customer be interested in, so that you know who to spend their money on advertising for? People like Fingerhut have made a very good living doing that. There are other classes as well. Diagnostic data mining is more monitoring for automatic control, and you can apply that in ERP and inventory management, where you can apply artificial intelligence to make decisions automatically in real time. One of the earlier applications I was familiar with is refinery stacks. That's completely out of the ERP domain, but they monitor the temperature all the way up the refinery stack so that they can set controls to make the output good. That's, to me, a good example of diagnostic. But that can also be applied in inventory. Prescriptive analytics is trying to optimize. Things like linear programming would be involved with that. And so in our program, we kind of cover at least three of those with separate classes. But there are a lot of different ways to apply data mining, is the point.
Sure. So Dr. Olson, just in the context of ERP then, you know, when you have ERP conversations, a lot of times data mining is a topic, right? What would you say, or what could you tell our listeners with these four models that you just described is currently most prevalent in terms of most ERP systems? Is it?
Well, I think CRM is the one that leaps to mind, and that's really predictive data mining. But you can also do things like, the inventory control is also predictive, and maybe even diagnostic. And those definitions are kind of semantics.
Sure.
They also can apply optimization models and things like determining the best place to buy a certain source of material. You can run an LP model to determine where to buy stuff, a transportation model, where to get stuff and send it where at the lowest cost. So they all show up a little bit, but I think the most prevalent is CRM.
Do you see that changing in the near future?
I think everything evolves. Like SAP bought Tableau, and they can find new ways. That's
right.
Visualization. That's descriptive.
Right.
They can find ways to utilize that. One thing that I've noted is that when Oracle or SAP buys something, they tend to market it as a cure-all. But, you know, when you get to the business application, it won't do exactly what maybe Oracle or SAP had in mind. The companies have to figure out how to use these tools for their own particular problems, and they might have to change the thinking a little bit.
Sure.
Dr. Olson, I can't agree more with you. You know, the technology is incredibly helpful, but at the end of the day, it's a human being often using that technology. And if it's not used in the mindset or behavior that links to make best use of that system, then are we really getting the returns? So fabulous thought. I want to switch gears just a little bit. With your definitions of data mining, I want to look a little deeper in your background in supply chain management. And if there is a year in my experience that clearly shows supply chain management is critical, it was 2020. And the disruptions of supply chains due to COVID-19. You've got a quote on your bio that I think really highlights your experience here and the whole range of supply chain. I'm going to read it for our listeners. Supply chain management professionals are involved in the process from raw material extraction to consumer purchase, ensuring the right product is in the hands of the right consumer at the right time. Given all the dislocation supply chains have faced this year, how does data mining, decision support, and business analytics help us move towards robust supply chains and resolve this dislocation from COVID-19? How do you see this?
Well, it's kind of, you know, I can't say that this is absolutely what's going on, but it seems to me that they have had a lot of issues in things like sourcing, where you need to select vendors. And, you know, when you cut off all the Chinese vendors in March, they had to have alternatives to go to. And if you had a good database of available alternatives, that would make that a lot easier. And so that's more of, I don't know if you could blame data mining or credit data mining, if that's the word for that, but certainly it's what they have to do in dealing with the trade-offs and cost versus risk, and that might be more of the analytic side of at the prescriptive part of data mining. Mm. Product design also involves a lot of trade-offs in quality and cost and reliability, and with the COVID-19 disruption, they've had to probably make decisions about sacrificing maybe a little bit of cost, possibly some quality or reliability, but not necessarily. They need to have alternatives available that they can quickly access to cope with that. And it looks to me like the economy seems to be doing okay other than, you know, outside of the service sector. They seem to have done a pretty good job with that, it looks like to me. In the logistics area, transportation models have been around since the 1930s for optimizing routing.
Sure.
They certainly have been challenged with that, and I'm sure that they have applied those models to decide where to ship what, where, and when. Inventory management has these same kinds of cost and stockout cost trade-offs, and holding cost and stockout cost trade-offs. Again, I think it goes back to the risk. There's probably more inventories now as people got scared. But then again, consumers, I mean, I went to the grocery store this morning. They still have signs saying one package of toilet paper each. I don't know why. There's lots of it on the shelves. But I think that there have been some disruptions consumer-wise, and so it's been really challenging. But to me, they seem to have coped pretty well. I lived through the 70s with OPEC, and they had gas lines you may have read about in your history books. People reacted much worse in the 1970s than I think they have this time around.
Sure. What an interesting comparison. I wouldn't have immediately gone to the OPEC dislocations.
Oh, it was – they had – I swear to God, Johnny Carson made a joke about a toilet paper shortage, and the next day all the grocery stores were out of toilet paper.
You're kidding.
And there was no reason. I mean, what does oil have to do with that? But people, you know, consumers react in very funny ways. And it's a very challenging thing for, like groceries, to keep things in stock. But they seem to be doing that. And I think my reading of the economy is that overall, outside of things like airlines and hotels and restaurants, things are doing pretty well. At the far end, you've got channel selection, and that gets us back to customer behavior. The retail end is a selection decision, and CRM is a very valuable tool to keep on top of that. And that's become an inherent part of every ERP system.
Sure. And there's all sorts of behaviors that we can apply analytics to. I want to follow up here because you said something earlier about the tension between a robust and a optimized supply chain. And I think this is the COVID experience is a great example of looking at that. Can you speak to that tension?
Yeah, I think there was a big drive in operations management towards lean manufacturing. And a lot of people said, well, you know, you're sacrificing things to do that. But when things are going well, supply chain squeeze, that's why you go overseas to get cheaper supply or lower labor costs or whatever. You're optimizing the cost part of it. But there are risks, and a pure lean system is zero inventory, but that's the riskiest possible environment too. If anything goes wrong, you're stuck. And a lot of companies have experienced things. One interesting case is Nokia and Ericsson and phones about 20 years ago. A little before that, Nokia had been burnt, and so they developed alternative supplies. And then they had a fire or something happened, a lightning-related incident in New Mexico of a key component in cell phones. And Ericsson got stuck and couldn't cope with it, and Nokia was experienced in that and was able to capture a big share of that part of the market. It doesn't last forever. I think Nokia had some real problems about 5 years ago again. So there's no silver bullet or cure-all, but being prepared, I think, is crucial to organizational survival, and Slack is necessary to do that.
So, Dr. Olson, I couldn't agree more. In my Masters of Business and my working experience as a consultant, lean is preached as a cure-all, in that we must be optimized for the what we expect. The tension I often see, and I want to get your reaction to this, is that if you don't have any slack and you are incorrect in your prediction with what the future looks like, then you have a worst case scenario because you're optimized for a situation that doesn't serve you.
But precisely.
If you have slack, then you are never fully optimized for any given scenario. So there will always be someone who can do something better, faster, cheaper in the current scenario in the short term. But over the long term, you have a huge competitive advantage. And so how do supply chain professionals think about this tension when they're looking at their businesses?
Well, I fear that what happens is that to keep their job, they have to optimize. So the stockholders usually look over their shoulder and expect them to have a perfect solution.
Yeah.
What you just said, I think, is right on target, and that's what I've always preached, is that if you want to survive the inevitable variances that occur, you got to have some spare. And that is a safety stock, and a safety stock is a permanent cost with no return. It's like... Well, it is exactly taking money out of the bank to put into this inventory that you never use, hopefully, until there's a problem. But then when there's a problem, it suddenly becomes very important and useful. But it's a matter of we never know what's going to happen. And I think humans are the kind of things with very short-term memories. And so if things go well for 10 years, they assume that everything's going to go perfectly well forever, and they squeeze out all of the slack. But then when things do go wrong, suddenly everybody starts to build up inventories again.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So this idea,
that's a behavioral issue, which is interesting.
And it's also a conversation on risk, right? Just trying to find this
absolutely.
Balance between lean versus slack, and just being aware of the risk. And so just to slightly change gears, Dr. Olson, to this idea of risk, clearly an important notion within any organization. I'm going to ask you to speak for a minute to this idea of risk in simulation model. But first, I wanted to share three excerpts from your work, if I may. I'm doing this for a reason, just to kind of emphasize a point here. But you and your colleagues published an article titled Enterprise Risk Management Small Business Scorecard Analysis, in which you stated, quote, production planning and control involves the need to consider risk in a systematic manner. Enterprise risk management, or ERP, has become important in all aspects of organizational operations. There are a number of quantitative tools available to support risk planning. An important tool is business scorecards. Furthermore, you wrote in an article titled Multiple Criteria Analysis for Evaluation of Information System Risk that, quote, information technology involves a wide set of risks. Enterprise information systems are a major developing form of information technology involving their own set of risks, thus creating potential blind spots. And the paper described risk management issues involved in enterprise resource planning systems, which have a high impact on organizations due to their high cost, their pervasive impact on organizations as well. And lastly, just one more quick quote, again, to reference your University of Nebraska bio page, you wrote, quote, risk modeling and supply chains to include identification of risk and modeling through risk matrices, selection decisions, Monte Carlo simulation, and balanced scorecards. Issues of natural disaster risk management and sustainability are also addressed. So clearly risk is a pretty important topic in our world of information and business systems. Can you distill down for our listeners why this idea of risk and simulation modeling is so important to understand in terms of supply chain management? which is, again, you know, a major piece of an organization's business information systems.
Yeah, I think many events can threaten organizations, and COVID-19 and 2020 obviously is one of those. Organizations need to be prepared, as we've talked about, which usually means that they have to develop some slack, as we've talked about, which hurts, and you have to pay for that slack. And you also need to have alternative sources of supply production available. Coping with that environment, I think, requires managers to think in terms of systems, to understand what to expect from various decision actions, because many things can happen, and they need to gather data and study their system and experiment and learn what causes and effects apply to them. And in the area of risk management, we've had four basic tools that I've tried to include in classes. One of those you mentioned was risk matrices, which are simple tools in the planning stage to try to prepare general responses to things that you expect might go wrong. That's a planning kind of an activity. Decision analysis is a form of multiple criteria analysis that is often useful to model the trade-offs to, you know, weight the relative criteria that are important, such as risk or return. You mentioned Monte Carlo simulation. That's a very powerful tool to take probabilities, however you can obtain them, either measured or estimated subjectively, and put into a system to include the variances that you expect to encounter and kind of test how robust the different alternatives you have available would be. And I, in the risk management class, spend half the class going over Monte Carlo simulation of business problems. Business scorecards you mentioned come from Kaplan. They're a very useful means to monitor what can go, how well the organization is doing on four different categories. So I've always pushed these four different tools to accomplish different things, risk matrices for planning, decision analysis for selection, Monte Carlo simulation for probabilistic analysis, and then to monitor risk and how well the organization's doing in accomplishing their plan would be the business scorecards.
So it's an integrated approach.
Absolutely, and they're not one or the other. They're all four different tools available.
So, Dr. Olson, in your experience, when you look at organizations, which ones do you feel are most likely to be implemented and ones that are not? Do you have any thoughts on that? Is it like typical that organizations, you know, they do the risk matrices, but the other three kind of go to the wayside? Or any thoughts on that?
Yeah, Monte Carlo simulation takes an expert in computer modeling. So that is something that's scary to many managers, possibly. It is heavily statistical, as well as, you know, you generate a lot of random numbers and it looks scary. Decision analysis is much easier to apply. You can do that on a spreadsheet. Risk matrices are extremely easy to implement, but they aren't as powerful either. Same with business scorecards. I mean, they're very easy to implement. But I think that in practice, you see probably more risk matrices for organizations that want to do that and business scorecards, primarily because of the ease of implementation. But I think the one that's the most useful is business simulation, Monte Carlo simulation. I worked in construction 9 years. If I'd have known how to do that, I would have driven them all crazy. there was so many places you could have applied that. But I worked before they had computers were at the corporate office. That was all back in the 70s. But you can do so much stuff. But it takes a lot of work. It's not tiddlywinks.
So probably one of the most valuable risk management tools, but in terms of time, money, and cost, it's one of the higher.
Yeah. You need to hire somebody that knows how to do it.
Sure.
Dr. Olson, one of the things I've seen when talking about implementing large-scale analytics in companies is that whether we have the tools for a Monte Carlo simulation is one thing, but oftentimes, managers and leaders, whether it's at the senior level or the line level, either do not understand the results from that analysis or misinterpreting them, or they simply don't trust them. And it's
absolutely
pretty hard to implement
something. That's precisely
something.
It. I think that's the major reason that it might not be used. And that's fair. I mean, if they're charged with the responsibility of running the company, if they don't understand it, they probably shouldn't use it.
You've got us here, and you've just given us a really important insight that organizations can get value out of these, but if the leaders or the people responsible for these organizations don't trust it, then it's pretty hard to get value out of this, and it makes sense they won't use it. So how does one deal with that tension in organizations of using this integrated approach, but recognizing it relies on human beings?
Yeah, I think it's an evolutionary thing over time. You know, you mentioned you have an MBA. MBA students get exposed to these things more and more. So with time, you get more managers that do understand them. I can remember there was a time when managers didn't understand computers back in the 70s and didn't trust them at all. That's changed completely now.
Yep.
So with time, things change. And if there's tools that are valuable, if they find that these tools have proved their value, then they start to adopt them or figure out how to use them.
Sure.
But you are absolutely correct. It's a matter of understanding and trust that needs to evolve.
So taking that and switching it a little bit about understanding evolution and trust, I want to ask you around ERP outsourcing, some of the risks, your thoughts on the process. You've authored an article specifically evaluating ERP outsourcing, and there's quite a few risks that come for that. Can you speak to our listeners about what would be the cost benefit of doing this, and what are really some of the hidden risks?
Sure. To me, it's a make or buy decision. And outsourcing to application service providers is
make or buy.
Of that. Yeah, so you can either build the system yourself or you can hire somebody else to do it, which is outsourcing. And that actually is the whole driver behind supply chains of going to China to get sources for materials. That's in a different context, but it's a make or buy decision. If you make it, you have a lot more control. If you buy it, you're at the mercy of whoever you hired. In ERP, third-party vendors can take on the cost of providing ERP support, and that's been done for decades in a large scale. If you remember Ross Perot, ZDS, they did essentially outsourcing for a lot of governmental computations. The risk of outsourcing ERP is the risk that the vendor can go out of business. They would be unable to fulfill their contract and leave you high and dry. Also, you have this thing called vendor lock-in, where they give you one price to begin with, but then as you become locked in and need them, and it would be very painful to leave, they arbitrarily raise their price in some cases. In general, it usually makes sense to outsource things that are not key and that you don't do particularly well, but retain those things that are key to your operations and things that you have a lot of strong competencies that you've developed internally.
And how do ERPs fit into that equation, in your experience?
The idea of hiring an application service provider is outsourcing ERP. You can do that.
Right.
You can hire somebody to run your ERP for you. It is usually, and it's been done successfully too. But then again, there are risks associated with that, as I said.
So, Dr. Olson, you know, obviously one of your areas of expertise is IT and ERP project management, which means from project initiation to planning to budgeting to, as we've discussed the last couple of minutes, risk mitigation, and then, of course, tactical execution. And I know this is kind of a high-level question intentionally, but if you had to pick just a couple of high-level points of advice for our listeners in terms of ERP organizational change execution, what would it be?
I think that the implementation has been a major problem, and it's a very large project with a lot of cost and time overruns. And so your question essentially is, how can you avoid those? I think that back in the 90s, there was a tendency for companies not to inform their employees very much and to view ERP as a way to reduce costs by laying most of them off. I think that being more open with employees seems to be more politically correct anyway, but I think it also is financially beneficial in that you try to explain how the ERP system is going to enable the organization to do more work and try to, well, the training element is a very important feature to get users to be able to use the system to improve their jobs. Now, if you do business process reengineering, that is going to inherently mean that they're going to have to change how they did their job, which makes them uncomfortable. But you need to do a lot of explaining as to why that's going to make their job more productive. Try to make them partners, I would say. Of course, that's easier for an academic to tell a businessman than otherwise. But it is very important to get the users involved in the implementation of the systems. And I think from my understanding, the industry is moving and has moved in that direction for quite a while.
So as a topic that's a significant part of my practice and in my research, which is ERP critical success factors, and I know you co-authored an article as well called CIO's Perspectives of Critical Success Factors in ERP Upgrade Projects. If you had to absolutely pick only three critical success factors, I'm going to put the pressure on here a little bit, for any project, what would you say they are? If you just had to give me three success factors, and obviously you referred to one in the previous question, which is training, but what would you say are the top three kind of those critical pieces of an ERP implementation?
Well, for any project, the three that have been traditional are top management support. If you don't have that, you don't get funding and they cancel the project. User involvement, which relates to the training aspect, without which project implementations won't work. And the sound project management process, like, you know, plan out what tasks need to be accomplished and how long they're going to take and how to sequence them and to how to communicate with the people that are building the project. And so those three, I think, also apply to the ERP domain, whether it's new installations or upgrades.
Sure. And I want to add, you had a paper I thought was really interesting, and I want to share it with our listeners, but it was you, and I believe it was Dr. Bocek, published an article. It was a case study of SAP implementation in a corporation network, in which you noted that, quote, in the study, it was found investigating in CSFs, critical success factors, of organizational change management and business process reengineering have a long-term cost reduction benefit, which will help right first-time implementations to offset the increase in initial ERP cost and lower the failure rate. So I think, you know, two other items on that list that you did in this really nice article would be, of course, proper and effective change management and proper and effective business process reengineering.
Right. That organization had problems in the business process reengineering and redesigning their work processes, primarily due to lack of two-way communication in that specific instance. So organizational change management would make that easier, primarily just with the communication aspect.
Sure.
Because it's one thing to plan a business process reengineering study, it's another to make it work. And to communicate with the users is about mandatory.
Absolutely. I mean, it's pretty hard to reengineer something with input if communication only goes one way. So, Dr. Olson, I want to, in closing, I want to take a second to leave the question a bit open-ended. So it's done by on purpose here. Based on your years of research and work, if you had to summarize and distill all the principles that you use when looking at and teaching ERP and supply chain for our listeners, and these are primarily practitioners and executives who are trying to understand the practical value of your work, what would you want our practitioners and our listeners to really learn and understand about how to put your work and insight into practice?
Well, overall, I think that the ERP and ERP-related systems like transportation management systems and warehouse management systems and whatever have always had an evolutionary character. And as developers make new and better tools, organizations often struggle to fit them into their particular needs, and I think we talked about that earlier. Developers need to think that one solution fits all, but each organization is different. And so they design for generic efficiency, which creates some issues for organizations with their own special problems. And so there's always, I think, some reason to modify the vendor product. And vendors discourage that, but it becomes necessary for a better fit with organizations. Another feature is ERP implementation that struck me is that you have an initial break-in period where efficiency used to drop significantly for about a year or so until the organization could digest the new system.
Sure.
A perfect business process reengineering would eliminate that, but that gets back to communicating with the people that have to use the system again. And it's very hard to get that. But I think, you know, more attention to business process reengineering would be highly important in making a system effective. It used to take years to implement an ERP. That's no longer the case because vendors have become very cognizant of that issue and have done a lot to shorten the installation time. But still, the first year is painful to organizations because users have to change very often how they do their jobs. And I've been convinced that organizations don't worry too much about cost. And sometimes organizations have spent so much on ERP implementations that they've gone broke. I'm biased towards business cases, although my impression is that they tend to be numbers made up to serve the agenda of management.
Sure.
Admittedly, the benefits of ERP systems are extremely difficult to accurately forecast. And I've long sought, you know, to study that, but they shouldn't share proprietary characteristics of such data. And that's actually something like where you would be in a position to know more about that because you gain a lot of experience by dealing with implementations and get access to that kind of information. But it is, I think, important to have a business case, but many times it's a matter of faith to make a leap to go ahead and invest in a system. Sometimes it's right, and it can also be terribly wrong.
Dr. Olson, thank you so much. What an insightful answer. And thank you for being on our podcast.
Yeah, Dr. Olson, thank you so much for your time today. And thanks for being a mentor. We truly appreciate your expertise, experience, and insight. Thank you again, and be well.
All right. Well, thank you very much for the time, and have a good day.
Thank you.
We are incredibly excited and grateful to have friends, colleagues, and mentors join us on our podcast. We have an incredible lineup of guests for ERP and organizational change, including speakers, authors, professors, researchers, pioneers in the field, practitioners, private equity partners and executives, ERP vendors, and organizational stakeholders. Please join us for our next episode with Dr. Timo Sandritter to discuss team performance business intelligence. Dr. Timo Sandritter is the president of RippleWorks, an organization that provides a holistic focus on the cognitive, emotional, and physical well-being of an organization's people. And before you go, please don't forget to click subscribe to the Organizational Change Journal podcast so you can hear our latest episodes. We invite you to leave us feedback and a review because we want to make sure this is the most useful and insightful podcast you listen to. And to do that, we need your help.
Thank you, Jonathan. And thank you, listeners, once again for being with us as we seek to, one, promote, connect, and foster relationships in the ERP organizational change community, two, contribute to the field of ERP organizational change, and three, bring research and practice closer together. Please join us again next week as we discuss the latest ERP organizational change research, practice, and stories. Our podcast will draw on knowledge from extensive research, collaborative learning, and practitioner expertise and experience.
From everyone at Nestle & Associates, Invert Ventures, and the rest of the team, thank you for listening. Have a fantastic week, and we hope to see you next time on the Organizational Change Journal podcast. Bye for now.